Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Colin Dunn on behalf of the Plaintiff Appellants. This is on appeal to this Court from a judgment entered by the District Court on our claims against the government, where he had found that the government was not liable. The theories that we espoused at trial were essentially two. One, that the FAA controlled the conduct of the air traffic controller, who we claimed was negligent, and two, that they should have installed a radar in that facility. Judge Dara found both of those theories to be true. However, he found that as to the first theory, he was barred from finding the government liable based on this Court's decision in Alinsky, and that as to the radar, that that decision was protected by the discretionary function exception. Both of those rulings, we believe, was erroneous, and it's those two issues I'd like to discuss today, although we have raised several issues in our briefs that we would certainly stand by. As to Judge Dara's finding...
Don't you have a serious problem with the Gilbert case about your having settled with Midwest?
But, Your Honor, no, that's... We did not settle with Midwest.
Gilbert said that doesn't make any difference. That's explicit in Gilbert. What? They say the fact that you settle and then you have a provision in there that, you know, it's not intended to affect any rights of the plaintiff against another tortfeasor, that just doesn't wash. That's what they said.
It's a little bit different because in this case, this was not a settlement.
It's a little bit different, but Gilbert's point is because the respondeat superior tortfeasor, the United States in this case, because it has a right of indemnity against the other tortfeasor, the one who settled, the settlement is illusory.
Well. But remember, this is not a settlement in either form or substance. There was no agreement between us and Midwest as to either the amount that we would receive or that there would be a finding against Midwest. There was no guarantee when we entered in this agreement that Midwest would be found liable.
What has that in? Settlements never involve a finding of liability.
The
point is Midwest, by making the settlement, capped its liability at $1 million. You, or a little under a million.
To us, but Midwest knew this was not a release of their potential liability. They knew about the Gilbert case.
But that's the same in Gilbert. That was the provision in Gilbert. Remember? That's what the court says. The fact that you decorate your settlement with language designed to avoid the indemnity rule doesn't work. He said.
But the difference is in this case, Judge, that had we dismissed the case, had we entered into the agreement with Midwest and decided it wasn't worth going after the government, we don't have a good case, let's dismiss the case and simply seek the money that they've argued that we've agreed to with Midwest, there was no enforceable agreement. We would have gotten zero had we tried to do that. There's no way we could have sought to enforce this agreement unless there was a finding of liability against Midwest. And because of that, we couldn't have sought, as I said, to go to either Judge Dara or any Illinois state court and sought to enforce that agreement. We couldn't have done it because it didn't promise us anything other than they would not appear at trial. And even that, there wasn't a complete promise because had they appeared, we gave them the option. If they wanted to appear, they certainly could have done so. But beyond that, we feel that Gilbert doesn't apply.
So are you saying that under Illinois law, the U.S., if found liable and hit with a big judgment, could not seek indemnity for Midwest?
We're saying under the Supreme Court's decision that the U.S. could not seek indemnity against its own employee. If Midwest were defined to be an employee, as Judge Dara found in this case, they couldn't seek indemnity against...
Why not? Because of the contract?
Well, in the contract, it actually has an indemnity clause in there, but in U.S. versus Gillum, the Supreme Court said that the United States cannot seek indemnity against its employees. They can't do it. So they're protected based on that, They're also protected because they never filed a cross-claim for indemnity in this case that I'm aware of. So there's no question that Midwest was protected against any sort of either implied or expressed indemnity against from the United States. And so really, you know, Gilbert was concerned about the fairness to the agent. And there's no question that in this case, there would be no potential indemnity against the agent. So okay. There's really no reason to use Gilbert in this case. And we've also argued that it shouldn't apply.
You wanted to discuss something else, so why don't you do that?
As to the Alinsky decision.
Your biggest problem is the discretionary function, I think, exemption.
And
I don't know how you get around that.
In all honesty, the second prong, which is what we generally rely on, I mean, we certainly argue that the contract required them to.
I don't get in, prongs. I don't know what you're
the second,
about.
The prong that requires the decision to be susceptible to policy analysis, that certainly, as we cited in our brief, the courts have had trouble with that prong. Commentators have complained about it. It's not easy to define.
What is more discretionary? You've got this TARDIS machine. And you have to decide, you know, which airports get it. And as I understand it, they just, at least at the time of the accident, they'd only installed in a handful of airports. Isn't that true?
That's
like
true.
Eight airports or something in the whole country?
That's true.
So there were hundreds of these little small airports around.
That's right. There were. But remember that.
So they're going airport by airport. So why isn't that a discretionary judgment? Are we going to put it in Waukegan or Miggs?
Well, remember that the first part of the test is whether it's discretionary. And certainly we agree that there was no statute or regulation that required it to be put in. So that's not an issue. Now, the second part is this the kind of thing that Congress intended to shield with this discretionary function exception? And we say no. The issue that Judge Dara had was what do I look at? Do I look at the actual policy that was in effect?
What is it you think the purpose of the discretionary function exception is?
It's to prevent judicial second guessing of decisions made by agencies based on legitimate factors that reasonable minds could differ on. So, for instance, they pro-offer a number of factors that they say went into the decision, economics, cost benefit. If I were to argue, well, the cost-benefit in our case in Waukegan favored us, and we should have had it in there, but they had the economics.
Well, look, as Judge Evans mentioned, there are hundreds of these airports. So how do we know that Waukegan need was more urgent than some other airport?
Well, remember that we're not arguing.
Negligence determination, right? They go airport by airport.
We're not arguing that every airport should have received a TARDIS.
Why this one rather than one of the several hundred others?
I think you have to argue that every airport would receive it it's discretionary.
But Judge Dara found that in this case they should have had it because of the 10 years that they qualified for the number of itinerant flights.
Look at the other airports, the other 500 airports.
But you know, the issue is that should this airport.
This is a prioritization question. And prioritization is the clearest example of discretion. You have a limited number of machines, limited resources, and you allocate it. And it's true, you know, the squeaky wheel gets oiled first, right? That's how things work. The noisy politicians, maybe they get it earlier, but I don't see how it ceases to be discretionary because they're listening to politicians. I mean, it is a democracy, you know, you get those things.
Because decisions made on those bases aren't consistent with what they're charged to do. Congress charged them to ensure the safety of flight, and when they're making decisions based on who asked for it, or whether or not there's a crash and we want to stem the tide of criticism, that's not consistent with trying to make sure that the flow of air traffic through the country is safe and secure.
I don't see how you can win unless you argue that every airport has to have it.
Well, I say that we don't argue that because we're limited to our case. And in our case, the judge found it was negligent not to have it. Now, that may be true in other airports. We just don't know that. It may not be true depending on crash by crash. It's a crash by crash, case by case situation, whether or not they should have had a TARDIS. In this case, Judge Darrow found that based upon the fact that they qualified for 10 years, based upon MIGS, the crash in MIGS, that they knew they had a problem here, based upon the fact that 2 years prior to this crash, they twice asked to go and check and see what airports qualified to be on this list, and they never did it, he found that to be negligent.
But I don't share your view about the politicians, because if you're a government agency making a discretionary judgment, and a politician calls you up, and you're entitled to listen to that. I mean, politicians have information, you know, they from their constituents, and I would think it would be legit. At some point, it becomes illegitimate, obviously, but again, it would be an element most government agencies would consider in making a discretionary judgment. I don't see an impropriety in that.
But Judge Darrow found that the line you had just drawn was crossed in this case. He didn't say, well, they considered requests from congressmen for providing important information to help them guide their decision as to whether or not a facility should receive a TARDIS. He found that their decision-making wasn't susceptible to policy analysis because it's requests from congressmen or other prominent people to get it. We have numerous examples. Senator Graham for the Texas Instruments people, Senator Levin. This isn't a situation where Congress is providing helpful guidance to the FAA as to my airport should get it or this airport should get it because it would effectuate the regulatory regime. It's simply the inference is these are my friends and we want an airport. We want an airport with a TARDIS. And I would just point out that the interpretation espoused by the government would render the second prong of the test, the susceptibility to policy analysis test, meaningless. Because their argument is that if we're given discretion...
See, I think you misunderstand it. I think when courts talk about policy, what they mean is that a judgment about negligence usually doesn't involve policy. You know, you have a pretty clear situation. You're driving on the wrong side of the street. You ran a red light, something of that sort. But when you start having to make judgment, say you have to start setting priorities, then you're using policy. I don't think the idea is it has to be good policy, it has to be sensible policy. That would just then say, well, there's no negligence, right? There's sensible policy.
But the problem is that in this case, it wasn't based on a setting of priority. That's what their argument was to the district court, and he rejected it.
Yeah, but don't you see how you're merging the discretionary function exception into the determination of negligence? You say, well, sure, if set on priorities, they'd have cost-benefit analysis and so on, fine. Well, but then they wouldn't be negligent, would they?
If they followed the policies that they espoused, they wouldn't be negligent, and it would be protected. You wouldn't even get to that.
But look, if it's not negligent, you don't need the protection of the discretionary function. The discretionary function exception has to do more than just identify cases where there's no negligence, right?
That's correct.
So what more does it do?
It protects them from abuses of discretion, for instance.
No. What do you mean it protects whom from what?
It protects the government. They can if it's a discretionary call and they abuse their discretion under the discretionary function.
So they abuse their discretion by listening to the politicians.
It's different because in our case...
Why is that a different abuse of discretion from anything else?
Because they were not... The basis for their decision was simply not susceptible. It wasn't consistent with their... charged by Congress.
Any abuse of discretion. What's an abuse of discretion that's consistent with what the agency is supposed to be doing?
Well, the difference is, in this case...
Suppose they do a cost-benefit analysis and they say, well, economists say human life of an American is worth $7 million, but we think there are too many people and so on, and we're going to say $70,000. That would be considered an error. That presumably is protected, right? So why is that protected, but if they listen to a politician, it's not protected?
Because the politician isn't offering guidance consistent with their mandate. In your example, that would not be consistent with their mandate of ensuring the safe, efficient flow of airline traffic in the country.
But it would be protected.
Well, that would be their argument, that it would be protected, but we would disagree with that.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Dunn. Mr. Riegel?
May it please the Court, Stephen Riegel, Department of Justice for the Appellee United States.
Where did you get the idea that this Gilbert rule has anything to do with subject matter jurisdiction?
I would not think it is a subject matter jurisdiction.
Why did you say it in your brief?
Well, we feel the...
That's what your brief says.
Okay.
Right?
We feel the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction for the two allegations that are front and center as to how they're seeking liability. Gilbert would be a mechanical,
no,
if you've got jurisdiction.
No, you don't understand subject matter jurisdiction. That's jurisdiction over the case.
I see.
Do you
point.
Think federal courts don't have jurisdiction over suits against the United States? Is that what you're saying?
No, sir. I, of course, would acknowledge.
That's what it means. Court lacks subject matter jurisdiction. It means has to dismiss the case without prejudice.
I see your point. If Gilbert is the issue,
no,
I would
not seeing it. There is no conceivable subject matter jurisdiction issue because the federal courts have jurisdiction over suits against the United States.
Correct. You're asking me about Gilbert, sir. If we're discussing...
I'm asking you first about why you thought there is an issue of subject matter jurisdiction in this case, something that would require us to order the suit dismissed without prejudice because the federal courts do not have authority to decide this case.
The answer to that, sir, is that the two exceptions which we cite, independent contractor and discretionary function, both relate to the fact that the Federal Tort Claims Act starts with sovereign immunity, amounts to a limited waiver of sovereign immunity, confers statutory exceptions, and if
so you say that any time you win a federal torts claims suit, instead of entering judgment for the government, the court should dismiss the suit for want of jurisdiction without prejudice?
Depends on how the United States wins. If it is determined that the suit was brought improperly against the United States because the actor was an independent contractor, as here, yes, that is outside the subject matter jurisdiction of the district court. That is our legal contention. Similarly, with respect to the discretionary function.
It shows it's not a good claim. Why do you want to have these suits dismissed without prejudice? I don't understand. Why don't you want just a judgment saying, no, the Federal Tort Claims Act was not violated because it was an independent contractor, was an employee of the United States?
The two parts to the question, Your Honor. My understanding is if this court agrees with Judge Dara and rules that the only claims the plaintiffs have are both outside the Federal Tort Claims Act, then the United States wins, and barring a writ of certiorari and a reversal from even a higher court, the case is over. I don't know that that is without prejudice. I do know it is without subject matter jurisdiction.
No. Did he dismiss for lack of jurisdiction?
He ruled, I could turn to his exact words, but he agreed with the two legal propositions I've just stated.
No, he says judgment is entered in favor of the defendant. You haven't asked us to modify his judgment to change it from a decision on the merits to a jurisdictional dismiss, right?
Nor will we, sir. An affirmance is fine.
But it's inconsistent with your argument.
I think we're arguing somewhat in circles, Your Honor. I believe I've stated it, but I do believe that if you start with sovereign immunity...
Then
and
you should have asked for a dismissal on the basis of lack of jurisdiction, which apparently you didn't do in the district court. You're not doing in this court.
Well, our motion about 4 years ago, when we sought to dismiss the case on motion, is typically framed in the alternative as a motion to dismiss and a motion for summary judgment. In this case, the two-part...
You don't do that. Well,
I've seen rulings both ways, Your Honor.
It's a jurisdictional issue. You have to decide that first.
Yes.
Anyway, go on to something else.
All right. Well, the appellants below are seeking millions of dollars of damages under the Federal Tort Claims Act. The district court, Judge Dara, after a full trial, held that both central provisions of their complaint...
Did you argue in the district court that the Alinsky case was collaterally estopped the claim here?
Not collateral estoppel, because it is different parties. We held that it is the Alinsky decision of a prior panel of this court is a legal construction of the same contract. Literally the same contract between the Federal Aviation Administration and Midwest.
You never argued collateral estoppel in district court?
Correct. We moved to dismiss, citing the independent contractor aspect, and we cited as authority the fact that the same proposition had been before Judge Zagel below and the prior panel of this court. But more importantly, because we can go around and around on the precedental effect of the prior Alinsky panel, we argued that the prevailing Supreme Court precedent, particularly under Logue and Orleans, determines the issue in this case. I'm speaking of, we have to take the issues separately, the independent contractor issue. It is undisputed on the day of the accident that the Waukegan Control Tower was staffed only by employees of Midwest Air Traffic Control Services, a private contractor. It's our contention that's not only the formal determination, or I should say the literal words of the contract, Exhibit 1 in our supplemental appendix, but it also is the substance of this. This is not a single contract. Plaintiffs are indeed indirectly challenging a major federal program that includes hundreds of towers nationwide, all administered under identical contracts. So our argument, both in the pretrial motion and when that was turned down, the cornerstone of our trial defense on this issue was the federal government may not be held responsible in tort for
the... What about the discretionary conception? Now, what is your conception of what its purpose is?
I think the Varig Airlines case, the U.S. Supreme Court, 1984, states it perhaps best. The marks the boundary between Congress's willingness to impose tort liability and its desire to protect certain government activities from exposure to suit by private individuals. I know that is always a conflict between individuals saying...
I don't understand that. What is it they're worried... What is Congress worried about in creating the exception?
To repeat what I just said, sir, is that... I'm sorry, what did you...
What is the problem Congress is concerned about?
Well, the problem is that governmental activities, if they were individually challenged by means of a tort lawsuit, there would be no end to it. Almost any private loss one could imagine, from a car accident in Yellowstone Park to any impact on private individuals could be traced back, given our broad government, to individual activities. And where there, as Your Honor had asked my opposing counsel in the questions there, there is always limited resources and conflicting activities. Bringing it down to this case, the FAA tries its best to spend the government's billions of dollars on air safety responsibly, but of course it cannot remotely fund all the possible competing claims for that. This gets down to how the government's money is spent, but there was testimony about the priorities given to O'Hare and given to the Chicago Air Traffic Control Center at Aurora over very small facilities operated by the government, like, say, Palwaukee, or over the contract facilities. This is indeed a challenge to how the very small towers, hundreds of them, are equipped. And that's what the discretionary function exception is all about. There's
what
a presumption.
About this,
what does it cost?
Sorry.
What does that cost to put that radar system in?
The equipment alone was somewhere in the $20,000 or $30,000 range for buying essentially a PC and a couple of backup screens and so forth, plus design time by the equipment people, finding a place for it and installing it and so forth. I think one could fairly say under $100,000.
Now there's been that Alinsky crash in 97 and this yes. one in 2000.
Yes.
What's going on now, 8 years later, well, little airports?
In the broad scheme of things, what was going on is the government was and is introducing a new national program called STARS, S-T-A-R-S, an acronym for a different kind of radar system. As that comes into play, it will free up certified radar displays called BRITES, B-R-I-T-E-S, in fairly major towers, and then those would be recycled, waterfalled in terms of the FAA down to the smaller towers. That's the plan. But it's also important to point out from the government's perspective as the operator and contractor of small towers that small air traffic control towers have always operated safely without radar displays for the controllers.
What do you mean by safely?
Well, the...
Just occasional crashes, collisions, 10 or 20 times what airlines experience.
Well, I don't...
So to equip 500 airports with this... system would cost maybe $20 million or something.
It could, and of course the FAA, there was testimony that as this STAR system, which cost billions, is deployed replacing 1960s technology in major towers like Midway, that their bright screens will be freed up and will be waterfalled down.
Hopefully penny wise and pound foolish. They're going to wait 10 years or so until you have this used equipment that you can shift to the little airports when you could buy this cheap stuff?
Well, the cheap stuff has its problems, Your Honor. There's a references in the record. There was limited testing.
The government is always doing that with gold plating, right?
Well, in this case...
The latest, the best. And, of course, their big computer projects usually never get done, right? They're abandoned, right?
It's hard to defend the overall wisdom of the government in total.
Right.
I will say in this case, Your Honor,
that's
talking...
That's argument. That's why we need the discretionary...
It is not in the sense
the
that...
...courts would take over the government and say, buy this stupid TARDIS system.
Were Your Honors to disagree with the wisdom of the FAA's decision, it's still discretionary.
Right.
We do stand on that privilege, and there's no... it is not appropriate for judicial second-guessing. I did want to come back and just say there's a difference between the uncertified and the certified systems. One reason the FAA is making its priority STARS and the BRITE system is that those are certified. Then controllers can count on them, can use them, can issue traffic advisories based on them. An uncertified system is sort of, well, it's over there, but you can't tell any airplane where he is in relation to it. It's a much less useful system, and this was part of the debate. Do we want to start putting right. non-standard, uncertified pieces of equipment in?
So you're saying, really, aren't you, that the FAA really didn't want to install TARDIS because it was a stopgap and was uncertified? And they installed a few places because the politicians are pestering them. Is that what it amounts to?
Essentially, they put them in as test sites here and there and looked at it. And then it came down, it was Mr. Ron Morgan who testified by deposition at trial. He was the head of the air traffic division. And as he testified, I thought convincingly, he said, I have two certified programs in the works, STARS and BRITE being one of them, another automatic one being another. I don't want to start diverting money to an uncertified program, establishing it. Let's concentrate our limited resources there. This, I think, was a responsible, safety-oriented, and budget-oriented decision. Most importantly for this court, it was clearly one that was made. We don't need just the presumption that we have. We've got the actuality of Mr. Morgan weighing and balancing these decisions.
Let me just ask you another question about the jurisdictional issue. It troubles me. Suppose you had forgotten to argue independent contractor. Somebody just had forgotten. And it comes up to us. Nobody argues it. Would we be obliged to notice it on our own and order the case dismissed?
We're we're back to the point Your Honor and I started with. On my assumption that this, that if it's an independent contractor, the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction, yes, sir, that is correct. This court would have to have the duty to point it out sua sponte, and we could raise it at any time.
Right. But I don't think federal courts have done that.
We'd like to think we're conscientious enough to notice when it's a contractor being sued rather than the federal employee. I think justice and the...
Because usual focus on jurisdiction is, does the court have power over the case when it was instituted? You know, so not picking at particular issues and saying that, well, if the elements of the suit, the elements of the cause of action are not all there, we have to exercise our independent review and actually throw it out.
I would think an essential element would be lacking if the plaintiff's theory of liability is that a private contractor was negligent.
But you could imagine the government making a mistake and just not arguing an independent contractor. I mean, suppose you decide as a matter of litigation policy that your strongest point is discretionary function, so rather hassle over whether these people are really employees of the U.S. because of very extensive FAA regulation. You're going to pass that and say, yeah, let's treat them as employees, but even so, there's no claim. You're saying, no, we would have to say, no, we can't allow you to make that concession, because if they're not employees, there's no subject matter jurisdiction. That would be a pretty awkward way to structure a federal tort claim suit.
I can't personally imagine a circumstance in which we would ignore a jurisdictional problem of that sort just to go on and say, but on the merits, it's so clear we should win. Jurisdiction is raised first. These are bright line, clear jurisdictional.
You argued that the discretionary function is also jurisdictional.
Yes, sir. It is another
first and second.
Well, it's raised before you get to the merits of how reasonable the action is. Were you to remove those two jurisdictional claims, then you'd be saying, well, was what the FAA did reasonable or not? Classic negligence analysis. We always, when a case goes to trial, we try to put the actors on and show, I think everyone likes to see taxpayer money being spent responsibly and wisely, as I believe it was in the Great Lakes region of the FAA here in the equipment operational decisions. But at the Justice Department, I cannot think of a case in which we would turn our back on a jurisdictional shortcoming as major as that faced by the appellants here, where they only have a contractor negligence action and where their equipment, their second part of their argument, is so solidly within the discretionary decisions of the government.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Riegel. So, Mr. Dunn, we'll give you 1 minute if you have anything further.
Just as of the subject matter issue, Your Honor, I believe Parrott versus United States by this court addressed that, and it said that that was something they had to raise. It was not subject matter, but it was in the line of an affirmative defense that they had to raise.
What is the name of that case?
I think Parrott versus United States. I think it was Justice Sykes that authored that. And I want to reiterate that this is not Alinsky. The case, the strict control test.
Spell Parrott.
P-A-R-R-O-T-T.
O-T-T. Okay. Thank you.
There was no legal construction by this court in Alinsky of the contract. It was waived, abandoned in the district court. The strict control issue was never presented to this court. In fact, it would be unfair to ask this court, and had it been done in Alinsky, to rule on that issue, because they only had one side of the story. It was simply an abandoned argument. You had the government's self-serving affidavit as the sole evidence on that issue. And in our case, it was the first time that that issue had actually been litigated.
Mm-hmm. Okay.